She cut short her South African family vacation because of safety concerns. People were threatening to go on strike at the hotels I was booked into if I showed up. I was told that nobody could guarantee my safety. Word spread around the internet that she was heiress to a $4.8 billion fortune, her father being the South African mining tycoon Desmond Sacco. I assumed this was true about her, right up until I alluded to her billions over lunch, and she looked at me like I was crazy. "I grew up on Long Island," she said. "Not in a Jay Gatsby-type estate," I said. "Not in a Jay Gatsby-type estate," Justine said. "My mum was single my entire life. She was a flight attendant. My dad sold carpets." She later emailed that while she grew up with a single mom who was a flight attendant and worked two jobs, when I was 21 or 22, she married well. "My stepfather is pretty well off, and I think there was a picture of my mum's car on my Instagram, which gave the impression that I'm from a wealthy family, so maybe that's another reason why people assumed I was a spoilt brat. I don't know, but I thought it was worth bringing it up to you." Years ago, I interviewed some white supremacists from Idaho's Aryan Nations compound about their conviction that the Bilderberg Group, a secretive annual meeting of politicians and business leaders, was a Jewish conspiracy. "How can you call it a Jewish conspiracy when practically no Jews go to it?" I asked them. "Well, they may not be actual Jews," one replied, "but they are," he paused, "Jewish." So there it was. At Aryan Nations, you didn't need to be Jewish to be a Jew. And the same was true on Twitter with the privileged racist Justine Sacco, who was neither especially privileged nor a racist, but it didn't matter. It was enough that it sort of seemed like she was. They were ANC supporters. One of the first things Justine's aunt told me when she arrived at the family home from Cape Town Airport was, "This is not what our family stands for, and now, by association, you've almost tarnished the family." At this, Justine started to cry. I sat looking at her for a moment. Then I tried to say something hopeful to improve the mood. "Sometimes things need to reach a brutal nadir before people see sense," I said. "So maybe you're our brutal nadir." "Wow," Justine said. She dried her eyes. "Of all the things I could have been in society's collective consciousness, it never struck me that I'd end up a brutal nadir." A woman approached our table, the restaurant manager. She sat down next to her, fixed her with an empathetic look, and said something at such a low volume I couldn't hear it. "Oh, you think I'm going to be grateful for this?" Justine replied. "Yes, you will," the woman said. "Every step prepares you for the next, especially when you don't think so. I know you can't see that right now. That's okay, I get it. But come on, did you really have your dream job?" Justine looked at her. "I think I did," she said. I got an email from the Gawker journalist Sam Biddle, the man who started the onslaught against Justine. One of Justine's 170 followers had sent him the tweet. He retweeted it to his 15,000 followers, and that's how it began. "The fact that she was a PR chief made it delicious," he emailed me. "It's satisfying to be able to say, okay, let's make a racist tweet by a senior IAC employee count this time. And it did, and I'd do it again." Her destruction was justified, Sam Biddle was saying, because Justine was a racist and because attacking her was punching up. They were cutting down a member of the media elite, continuing the civil rights tradition that started with Rosa Parks, the hitherto silenced underdogs shaming into submission the powerful racist. But I didn't think any of those things were true. If punching Justine Sacco was ever punching up, and it didn't seem so to me, given that she was an unknown PR woman with 170 Twitter followers, the punching only intensified as she plummeted to the ground. Punching Joan Allera wasn't punching up either, not when he was begging for forgiveness in front of that giant screen Twitter feed. A life had been ruined. What was it for? Just some social media drama? I think our natural disposition as humans is to plod along until we get old and stop. But with social media, we've created a stage for constant, artificial, high dramas. Every day a new person emerges as a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. It's all very sweeping and not the way we actually are as people. What rush was overpowering us at times like this? What were we getting out of it? I could tell Sam Biddle was finding it startling too, like when you shoot a gun and the power of it sends you recoiling violently backwards. He said he was surprised to see how quickly Justine was destroyed. I never wake up and hope I get to fire someone that day, and certainly never hope to ruin anyone's life. Still, his email ended, he had a feeling she'd be fine eventually, if not already. Everyone's attention span is so short. They'll be mad about something new today. When Justine left me that evening to clear out her desk, she only got as far as the lobby of her office building before she collapsed on the floor in tears. Later, we talked again. I told her what Sam Biddle had said, about how she was probably fine now. I'm sure he wasn't being deliberately glib. He was just like everyone else who participates in mass online destruction. Who would want to know? Whatever that pleasurable rush that overwhelms us is, group madness or whatever, nobody wants to ruin it by facing the fact that it comes with a cost. Well, I'm not fine, Justine said. I'm really suffering. I had a great career and I loved my job and it was taken away from me and there was a lot of glory in that. Everybody else was very happy about that. I cried out my body weight in the first 24 hours. It was incredibly traumatic. You don't sleep. You wake up in the middle of the night forgetting where you are. All of a sudden you don't know what you're supposed to do. You've got no schedule. You've got no purpose. I'm 30 years old. I had a great career. If I don't have a plan, if I don't start making steps to reclaim my identity and remind myself of who I am on a daily basis, then I might lose myself. I'm single, so it's not like I can date, because we Google everyone we might date, so that's been taken away from me too. How am I going to meet new people? What are they going to think of me? She asked me who else was going to be in my book about people who'd been publicly shamed. Well, Jonah Lehrer so far, I said. How's he doing? She asked me. Pretty badly, I think, I said. Badly in what way? She looked concerned, I think more for what this might prophesize about her own future rather than Jonah's. I think he's broken, I say. When you say Jonah seems broken, what do you mean? Justine said. I think he's broken and that people mistake it for shamelessness, I said. People really were very keen to imagine Jonah as shameless, as lacking in that quality, as if he was something not quite human that had adopted human form. I suppose it's no surprise that we feel the need to dehumanise the people we hurt, before, during, or after the hurting occurs. But it always comes as a surprise. In psychology it's known as cognitive dissonance. It's the idea that it feels stressful and painful for us to hold two contradictory ideas at the same time, like the idea that we're kind people and the idea that we've just destroyed someone. And so to ease the pain, we create illusory ways to justify our contradictory behaviour. It's like when I used to smoke, and I'd hope the tobacconist would hand me the pack that reads, smoking causes ageing of the skin, instead of the pack that reads, smoking kills, because ageing of the skin, I didn't mind that. Justine and I agreed to meet again, but not for months, she told me. We'd meet again in 5 months. I am compelled to make sure that this is not my narrative, she said. I can't just sit at home and watch movies every day and cry and feel sorry for myself. I'm going to come back. She wasn't like Jonah, Jonah lied over and over again. He was a fraud. I don't know how you can bounce back when you've sacrificed your character and lied to millions. I just have to believe that there's a stark difference between that and my making a tasteless joke. I did something stupid, but I didn't trash my integrity. She said her job now was to avoid falling into depression and self-loathing. I think the next 5 months are going to be really fucking crucial for me, and then we'll know. She couldn't bear the thought of being preserved within the pages of my book as a sad case. She was determined to show the people who had smashed her up that she could rise again. "How can I tell my story," she said, "when it's really just beginning?" The day after my lunch with Justine, I caught the train to Washington, D.C. to meet someone I had prejudged as a frightening man, a fearsome American narcissist, Judge Ted Poe. For 20 years in Houston, Texas, Poe's nationally famous trademark was to publicly shame defendants in the showiest ways he could dream up, using citizens as virtual props in his personal theatre of the absurd, as the legal writer Jonathan Turley once put it. Given society's intensifying eagerness to publicly shame people, I wanted to meet someone who'd been doing it professionally for decades. What would today's citizen shamers think of Ted Poe, his personality and his motivations, now they were basically becoming him? What impact had his shaming frenzy had on the world around him, on the wrongdoers and the bystanders and himself? Ted Poe's punishments were sometimes zany, ordering petty criminals to shovel manure, etc., and sometimes as ingenious as a Goya painting, like the one he handed down to a Houston teenager, Mike Hubachek. In 1996, Hubachek had been driving drunk at 100 miles an hour with no headlights. He crashed into a van carrying a married couple and their nanny. The husband and the nanny were killed. Poe sentenced Hubachek to 110 days of boot camp and to carry a sign once a month for 10 years in front of high schools and bars that read, "I killed two people while driving drunk," and to erect a cross and a Star of David at the scene of the crash and to keep it maintained and to keep photographs of the victims in his wallet for 10 years and to send $10 every week for 10 years to a memorial fund in the names of the victims and to observe the autopsy of a person killed in a drink driving accident. Punishments like these had proved too psychologically torturous for other people. A 17-year-old boy called Kevin Tunnell had in 1982 killed a girl, Susan Herzog, while drink driving near Washington, D.C. Her parents sued him and were awarded $1.5 million in damages, but they offered the boy a deal. They would reduce the fine to just $936 if he'd mail them a cheque for $1 made out in Susan's name every Friday for 18 years. Gratefully accepted their offer. Years later, the boy began missing payments, and when Susan's parents took him to court, he broke down. Every time he filled in her name, he said, the guilt would tear him apart. "It hurts too much," he said. He tried to give the Herzogs 2 boxes of pre-written checks, dated 1 per week until the end of 2001, a year longer than was required. But they refused to take them. Judge Ted Poe's critics, like the civil rights group, the ACLU, argued to him the dangers of these ostentatious punishments, especially those that were carried out in public. They said it was no coincidence that public shaming had enjoyed such a renaissance in Mao's China and Hitler's Germany and the Ku Klux Klan's America. It destroys souls, brutalising everyone, the onlookers included, dehumanising them as much as the person who was being shamed. How could Poe take someone with such low self-esteem that they needed to, say, rob a store, and then hold them up to officially sanctioned public ridicule? But Poe brushed these criticisms off. Criminals didn't have low self-esteem, he argued. It was quite the opposite. The people I see have too good a self-esteem, he told the Boston Globe in 1997. Some folks say everyone should have high self-esteem, but sometimes people should feel bad. Poe's shaming methods were so admired in Houston society that he ended up getting elected to Congress as the representative for Texas's 2nd Congressional District. He is currently Congress's top talker, according to the Los Angeles Times, having made 431 speeches between 2009 and 2011 against abortion, illegal immigrants, socialized health care, etc. He always ends them with this catchphrase, and that's just the way it is. It wasn't the theatre of the absurd. Ted Poe sat opposite me in his office in the Rayburn House office building in Washington, D.C. I just quoted to him his critic Jonathan Turley's line, using citizens as virtual props in his personal theatre of the absurd, and he was bristling. He wore cowboy boots under his suit, another Poe trademark, like the catchphrase and the shaming. He had the look and mannerisms of his friend George W. Bush. It was the theatre of the different, he said. The Rayburn Building is where all the congressmen and women have their offices. Each office door is decorated with the state flag of whichever congressman is inside, the bald eagle of Illinois and North Dakota, and the bear of California, and the horse's head of New Jersey, and the strange bleeding pelican of Louisiana. Poe's office is staffed by handsome, serious-looking Texas men and tough, pretty Texas women who are all extremely nice to me but totally ignored all my subsequent email requests for clarifications and follow-up interviews. Although Poe ended the interview by warmly shaking my hand, I suspect that the moment I left the room he told his staff, "That man was an idiot. Ignore all future email requests from him." He recounted to me some of his favourite shamings. Like the young man who loved the thrill of stealing, I could have put him in jail, but I decided that he had to carry a sign for 7 days. "I stole from this store. Don't be a thief, or this could be you." He was supervised. We worked all the security out. I got that down to an art for those people who worried about security. At the end of the week, the store manager called me. All week, I didn't have any stealing going on in the store. The store manager loved it. "But aren't you turning the criminal justice system into entertainment?" I said. "Ask the guy out there," Ted Poe replied. "He doesn't think he's entertaining anybody." "I don't mean him," I said. "I mean the effect it has on the people watching." "The public liked it," Poe nodded. "People stopped and talked to him about his conduct. One lady wanted to take him to church on Sunday and save him. She did." Poe let out a big high-pitched Texas laugh. She said, "Come with me, you poor thing." End of the week, I brought him back into court. He said it was the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to him. It changed his conduct. Eventually, he got a bachelor's degree. He's got a business in Houston now. Poe paused. "I have put my share of folks in the penitentiary. 66% of them go back to prison. 85% of the people we publicly shamed, we never saw again. It was too embarrassing for them the first time. It wasn't the theatre of the absurd. It was the theatre of the effective. It worked." Poe was being annoyingly convincing, even though his recidivism argument was a misleading one. He was far more likely to sentence a first-time offender to a shaming, someone who was already feeling scared and remorseful and determined to change. But even so, I was learning something about public shaming today that I hadn't anticipated at all. It had started earlier that morning in my hotel room when I telephoned Mike Hubachek, the teenager who'd killed 2 people while drunk driving in 1996. I'd wanted him to describe the feeling of being forced to walk up and down the side of the road holding a placard that read, "I killed 2 people while driving drunk." But first we talked about the crash. He told me he spent the first 6 months after it happened lying in his prison cell, replaying it over and over. "What images did you replay?" I asked him. None, he replied. I had completely blacked out during it, and I don't remember anything. But I thought about it daily. I still do. It's a part of me. I suffered a lot of survivor's guilt. At the time, I almost convinced myself I was in a living purgatory. I lived to suffer. I went more than a year and a half without looking in a mirror. You learn to shave using your hand as a guide. Being in purgatory, he said, he had resigned himself to a lifetime of incarceration, but then Ted Poe unexpectedly pulled him out, and he suddenly found himself walking up and down the side of the road, holding that placard. And there, on the side of the road, he said, he understood that there was a use for him. He could basically become a living placard that warned people against driving drunk. And so now he lectures in schools about the dangers. He owns a halfway house, Sober Living Houston, and he credits Judge Ted Poe for it all. I'm forever grateful to him, he said. My trip to Washington, D.C. wasn't turning out how I'd hoped. I'd assumed that Judge Ted Poe would be such a terrible person, a negative role model, that the social media shamers would realise with horror that this was what they were becoming and vow to change their ways. But Mike Hupacek thought his shaming was the best thing that had ever happened to him. This was especially true, he told me, because the onlookers had been so nice. He'd feared abuse and ridicule, but no. 90% of the responses on the street were, God bless you, and things will be okay, he said. Their kindness meant everything. It made it all right. It set him on his path to salvation. Social media shamings are worse than your shamings, I suddenly said to Ted Poe. He looked taken aback. They are worse, he replied. They're anonymous. Or even if they're not anonymous, it's such a pile-on, they may as well be, I said. They're brutal, he said. I suddenly became aware that throughout our conversation, I'd been using the word they. And each time I did it, I felt like I was being spineless. The fact was, they weren't brutal. We were brutal. In the early days of Twitter, there had been no shamings. We were Eve in the Garden of Eden. We chatted away unself-consciously. As somebody wrote back then, Facebook is where you lie to your friends. Twitter is where you tell the truth to strangers. Having funny and honest conversations with like-minded people I didn't know got me through hard times that were unfolding in my actual house. Then came the Jan Moyer and the LA Fitness shamings, shamings to be proud of, and I remembered how exciting it felt when hitherto remote evil billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and Donald Trump created their own Twitter accounts. For the first time in history, we sort of had direct access to ivory tower oligarchs like them. We became keenly watchful for transgressions. After a while, it wasn't just transgressions we were keenly watchful for. It was misspeakings. Fury at the terribleness of other people had started to consume us a lot, and the rage that swirled around seemed increasingly in disproportion to whatever stupid thing some celebrity had said. It felt different to satire or journalism or criticism. It felt like punishment. In fact, it felt weird and empty when there wasn't anyone to be furious about. The days between shamings felt like days picking fingernails, treading water. I'd been dismayed by the cruelty of the people who tore Jonah apart as he tried to apologise, but they weren't the mob. We were the mob. I'd been blithely doing the same thing for a year or more. I had drifted into a new way of being. Who were the victims of my shamings? I could barely remember. I only had the vaguest recollection of who I'd piled onto and what terrible thing they'd done to deserve it. This is partly because my memory has degenerated badly these past years. In fact, I was recently at a spa. My wife booked it for me as a special surprise, which shows that she really doesn't know me because I don't like being touched. and as I lay on the massage table, the conversation turned to my bad memory. "I can hardly remember anything about my childhood," I told the masseuse. "It's all gone." "A lot of people who can't remember their childhoods," she replied as she massaged my shoulders. "It turns out they were sexually abused by their parents." "Well, I'd remember that," I said. But it wasn't just the fault of my lousy memory. It was the sheer volume of transgressors I'd chastised. How could I commit to memory that many people? Well, there were the spam bot men. For a second in Poe's office, I reminisced fondly on the moment someone suggested we gas the cunts. That had given me such a good feeling, it felt a shame to interrogate it, to question why it had beguiled me so. "The justice system in the West has a lot of problems," Poe said, "but at least there are rules. You have basic rights as the accused. You have your day in court. You don't have any rights when you're accused on the internet. And the consequences are worse. It's worldwide, forever." It felt good to see the balance of power shift so that somebody like Poe was nervous of people like us. But he wouldn't sentence a person to hold a placard for something they hadn't been convicted of. He wouldn't sentence someone for telling a joke that came out badly. The people we were destroying were no longer just people like Jonah, public figures who had committed actual transgressions. They were private individuals who really hadn't done anything much wrong. Ordinary humans were being forced to learn damage control, like corporations that had committed PR disasters. It was very stressful. "We are more frightening than you," I said to Poe, feeling quite awed. Poe sat back in his chair, satisfied. "You are much more frightening," he said. "You are much more frightening." We were much more frightening than Judge Ted Poe. The powerful, crazy, cruel people are usually right about tend to be in far-off places. The powerful, crazy, cruel people were now us. It felt like we were soldiers in a war on other people's floors, and there had suddenly been an escalation in hostilities. Chapter 5. Man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization. Group madness. Was this the explanation for our shaming frenzy, our escalating war on floors? It's an idea that gets invoked by social scientists whenever a crowd becomes frightening. Take the London riots of August 2011. The violence had begun with police shooting to death a Tottenham man, Mark Duggan. A protest followed, which turned into 5 days of rioting and looting. The rioters were in Camden Town, a mile from my house, smashing up kebab shops and JB Sports and Dixon's and Vodafone stores. Then they were in Kentish Town, half a mile down the hill from us. We frantically locked our doors and stared in horror at the TV news. The crowd had become contaminated, according to Dr. Gary Slutkin of the World Health Organization, quoted in The Observer, by a virus that infects the mind and causes a collective, communal, groupthink-motivated violence. It sounded like a zombie film. In The Guardian, Jack Levin, a professor of sociology and criminology at Northeastern University in Boston, called the riots the violent version of the Mexican wave. People are infected with emotional contagion. It is a feature of every riot. People get together in a group and commit acts of violence that they would never dream of committing individually. Luckily, the rioting fizzled out at the bottom of our hill that night, which, now I thought about it, didn't sound like the violent version of the Mexican wave at all. If the rioters really had lost their mind to a horrifying virus, you'd think they'd have carried on up the hill. Our hill, Highgate West Hill, was a very steep hill, one of the steepest in London. I think the rioters made the extremely lucid decision to not climb it. It turns out that the concept of group madness was the creation of a 19th century French doctor called Gustave Le Bon. His idea was that humans totally lose control of their behaviour in a crowd. Our free will evaporates. A contagious madness takes over. A complete lack of restraint. We can't stop ourselves. So we riot or we jubilantly tear down Justine Sacco. It wasn't easy to learn about Gustave Le Bon. For the father of such an enduring theory, almost nothing has ever been written about him. Only one man has ever tried to piece his life story together. Bob Nye, a professor of European intellectual history at Oregon State University. Le Bon was from a provincial town in the west of France, he told me over the telephone, but he decided he wanted to go to medical school in Paris. This was a France so wary of the crowd that in 1853, when Le Bon was 12, Napoleon III commissioned the town planner, Georges-Eugène Haussmann, to demolish Paris's twisted medieval streets and build long, wide boulevards instead. Urban planning as crowd control. It didn't work. In 1871, Parisian workers rose up in protest against their conditions. They took hostages, local bureaucrats and police officers who were tried and executed. The government fled to Versailles. Le Bon was a great admirer of the Parisian elite, even though the Parisian elite didn't seem the slightest bit interested in him. He was making a living as an ambulance driver at the time. And so he was hugely relieved when 2 months into the revolution, the French army stormed the commune and killed something like 25,000 rebels. The uprising had been traumatizing for Le Bon, and in its aftermath, he decided to embark upon an intellectual quest. Could he prove, scientifically, that mass revolutionary movements were just madness? And, if so, could he dream up ways the elite might benefit from managing the insanity? It could be his ticket into the upper echelons of Parisian society, because that was exactly the kind of thing an elite liked to hear. He began his odyssey by spending a number of years among the Anthropological Society of Paris's huge collection of human skulls. He wanted to demonstrate that aristocrats and businessmen had bigger brains than everybody else and were less likely to succumb to mass hysteria. He'd take a skull and fill it with buckshot, Bob Nye explained to me. Then he'd count the number of pieces of buckshot in order to determine volume. After measuring 287 skulls, Le Bon revealed in his 1879 paper, Anatomical and Mathematical Researches into the Laws of Variation of Brain Volume and Their Relation to Intelligence, that the biggest brains did indeed belong to aristocrats and businessmen. He reassured readers who might have been worried that the body of the Negro is larger than our own, that their brain is less heavy. Women's brains were less heavy too. Among the Parisians there were a large number of women whose brains are closer in size to those of gorillas than to the most developed male brains. This inferiority is so obvious that no one can contest it for a moment. Only its degree is worth discussion. All psychologists who have studied the intelligence of women, as well as poets and novelists, recognise today that they represent the most inferior forms of human evolution and that they are closer to children and savages than to an adult civilised man. They excel in fickleness, inconsistency, absence of thought and logic, and incapacity to reason. He conceded that a few distinguished women did exist. But they are as exceptional as the birth of any monstrosity. Consequently, we may neglect them entirely. And this, he argued, was why feminism must never be allowed to flourish. A desire to give them the same education and to propose the same goals for them is a dangerous chimera. The day when, misunderstanding the inferior occupations which nature has given her, women leave the home and take part in our battles. On this day, a social revolution will begin, and everything that maintains the sacred ties of the family will disappear. When I was writing my biography of Le Bon, Bob Nye told me, he seemed to me the biggest asshole in the whole of creation. Le Bon's 1879 paper was a disaster. Instead of welcoming him into their ranks, the leading members of the Anthropological Society of Paris mocked him, calling him a misogynist with shoddy scientific methods. For Le Bon, woman is seemingly an accursed being, and he predicts abomination and desolation if woman leaves home, the Society's Secretary-General, Charles Letourneau, announced in a speech. We naturally have all kinds of reservations about this conclusion. Stung by the humiliation, Le Bon left Paris. He travelled to Arabia. He asked the French Ministry of Public Instruction to fund his trip, proposing to undertake a study of Arabians' racial characteristics, which would be useful were they ever to fall under French colonial domination. But his request was denied, and so he paid for the trip himself. Over the next decade, he wrote and self-published several books on the neurological inferiority of Arabians, criminals, and exponents of multiculturalism. He was honing his craft. As Bob Nye solicitously put it in his Le Bon biography, The Origins of Crowd Psychology, he was now concentrating on brevity, using no sources or notes, and writing in a simple and graceful style. What Bob Nye meant was that there was no more skulls and buckshot, no more evidence gathering, just certainty. And it was in this style that, in 1895, he published the book that finally made him famous, The Crowd. It began with Le Bon's proud announcement that he wasn't part of any recognised scientific society. To belong to a school is necessarily to espouse its prejudices, he wrote. And after that, for 300 pages, he explained why the crowd was insane. By the mere fact that he forms part of an organised crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization. Isolated, he may be a cultured individual, but in a crowd he is a barbarian, that is, a creature acting by instinct. In a crowd, every sentiment and act is contagious. Every simile Le Bon used to describe an individual in the crowd highlighted his or her mindlessness. In a crowd, we are microbes infecting everyone around us, a grain of sand amid other grains of sand, which the wind stirs up at will. We are impulsive, irrational, irritable, characteristics which are almost always observed in beings belonging to inferior forms of evolution, in women, savages, and children, for instance. It was no wonder Le Bon had identified in women, ethnic groups and children, a universal trait of irritability, if that was the way he talked about them. But the crowd was more than a polemic. Like Jonah Lehrer, Le Bon knew that a popular science book needed a self-improvement message to become successful. And Le Bon had two. His first was that we really didn't need to worry ourselves about whether mass revolutionary movements like communism and feminism had a moral reason for existing. They didn't. They were just madness. So it was fine for us to stop worrying about that. And his second message was that a smart orator could, if he knew the tricks, hypnotise the crowd into acquiescence or whip it up to do his bidding. Le Bon listed the tricks. A crowd is only impressed by excessive sentiments. Exaggerate, affirm, resort to repetition, and never attempt to prove anything by reasoning. The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind, was, on publication, a runaway success. It was translated into 26 languages and gave Le Bon what he always wanted, a place at the heart of Parisian society, a place he immediately abused in a weird way. He hosted a series of lunches, Les Déjeuners de Gustave Le Bon, for politicians and prominent society people. He'd sit at the head of the table with a bell by his side. If one of his guests said something he disagreed with, he'd pick up the bell and ring it relentlessly until the person stopped talking. All over the world, famous people began declaring themselves Le Bon fans, like Mussolini. I have read all the work of Gustave Le Bon, and I don't know how many times I have reread The Crowd, It is a capital work to which, to this day, I frequently refer. And Goebbels. Goebbels thinks that no one since the Frenchman Le Bon has understood the mind of the masses as well as he, wrote Goebbels' aide, Rudolf Semler, in his wartime diary. Given all of this, you'd think Le Bon's work might have, at some point, stopped being influential. But it never did. I suppose one reason for his enduring success is that we tend to love nothing more than to declare other people insane. And there's another explanation. One psychology experiment, more than any other, has kept his ideas alive. It's the one created in a basement at Stanford University in 1971 by the psychologist Philip Zimbardo. Zimbardo was a working-class New York City boy, the son of Sicilian immigrants. After graduating from Brooklyn College in 1954, he taught psychology at Yale and NYU and Columbia before ending up at Stanford in 1971. Crowd theory, or de-individuation, as it was by then known, preoccupied Zimbardo so deeply that in 1969 he wrote a kind of prose poem to it. The ageless life force, the cycle of nature, the blood ties, the tribe, the female principle, the irrational, the impulsive, the anonymous chorus, the vengeful furies. Now, at Stanford, with funding from the US Office of Naval Research, he set about trying to dramatically prove its existence. He began by placing a small ad in the local paper. Male college students needed for psychological study of prison life, $15 per day for 1 to 2 weeks, beginning August 14th. After selecting 24 applicants, he turned the windowless basement of the psychology department into a mock prison, with cells and a solitary confinement room, a janitor's closet. He split the students into two groups. 9 would be prisoners, 9 guards, and the remaining 6 would be on call. He gave the guards batons and mirrored sunglasses so nobody could see their eyes. He designated himself the role of superintendent. The prisoners were stripped and put into smocks. Chains were placed on their feet. They were sent to their cells, and it began. The experiment was abandoned 6 days later. It had, Zimbardo later explained to a US congressional hearing, spiraled violently out of control. Zimbardo's fiancée, Christina Maslach, had visited the basement and was horrified by what she saw. The guards were strutting sadistically around, screaming at the prisoners to fuck the floor, and so on. The prisoners were lying in their cells yelling, I'm burning up inside, don't you know? I'm all fucked up inside. Maslach furiously confronted her fiancé. What are you doing to these boys? You're a stranger to me. The power of the situation has transformed you from the person I thought I knew to this person I didn't know. At this, Zimbardo felt like he'd been slapped awake. She was right. The experiment had turned evil. I have to end this, he said to her. What we saw was frightening, Zimbardo told the congressional hearing 2 months later. In less than a week, human values were suspended and the ugliest, most base, pathological side of human nature surfaced. We were horrified because we saw boys treat other boys as if they were despicable animals, taking pleasure in cruelty. Zimbardo released a selection of clips from the footage he covertly filmed throughout the experiment. In them, the guards were seen screaming at the prisoners, What if I told you to get down on the floor and fuck the floor? And, You're smiling, prisoner 2093. You get down there and do 10 push-ups. And, You're Frankenstein. You're Mrs. Frankenstein. Walk like Frankenstein. Hug her. Tell her you love her. And so on. As a result, and to this day, Zimbardo's basement has become, for students of social psychology, the incarnation of Le Bon's crowd, a place of contagion where good people turned evil. As Zimbardo told the BBC in 2002, we put good people in an evil place, and we saw who won. But I couldn't help thinking that the evil actions captured in Zimbardo's covertly filmed footage looked a bit hammy. Plus, whilst I knew only too well how a psyche can be mangled by sleep deprivation, I have raised a teething, colicky baby, and by being forced into a windowless room, I once spent an ill-advised week in an inside cabin on the Mediterranean cruise ship the Westerdam, and I'm sure I too would have repeatedly screamed, "I'm all fucked up inside, don't you know," were it not for my freedom to visit the Explorations Cafe and Vista Lounge whenever I liked. At no point, even on the worst nights, did I turn into someone from the Stanford Prison Experiment. What had really gone on in that basement? Nowadays, John Mark works as a medical coder for a health insurance company. But for 6 days, back in 1971, he was one of Zimbardo's guards. Tracking down the participants hadn't been an easy task. Zimbardo has never released all of their names. But John Mark has published letters about his memories of the experiment in the Stanford Alumni magazine, which was how I discovered him. "What happens when you tell people you were a guard in the Stanford prison experiment?" I asked him over the telephone. "Everyone assumes I was brutal," he replied. He sighed. "I hear it all the time. You turn on the TV and they'll be talking about anything to do with brutality, and they'll drop in, 'as was shown in the Stanford prison experiment. They were studying it in my daughter's high school. It really upsets me.'" "Why?" I asked. "It's not true," he said. "My days as a guard were pretty boring. I just sat around. I was on the day shift. I woke the prisoners up, brought them their meals. The vast majority of the time was just hanging out." He paused. If Zimbardo's conclusion was the true conclusion, wouldn't it have applied to all the guards? Then he said that if I looked closely at Zimbardo's clips, and he wished Zimbardo would release the full footage one day, I'd see that the only guard who really seemed to lose his mind was Dave Eshelman. "Dave Eshelman," I said. He was right. When you picture the evil guards in Zimbardo's basement, really, you're picturing one man, Dave Eshelman. He was the man who yelled, "Fuck the floor," and "You're Frankenstein," and so on. Social scientists have written papers analysing Eshelman's every move in there, including the strange detail that the more brutally he behaved, the more American South his accent sounded. I saw at least one analysis of the experiment where the author seemed to find it perfectly plausible that if a person was overcome by a violent madness, he'd involuntarily start to sound like someone from Louisiana. Nowadays, Dave Eshelman runs a home loan company in Saratoga, California. I telephoned him to ask how it felt to personify the evil that lies within all of us. "I think I did a pretty damn good acting job," he replied. "What do you mean?" I said. This was not a simple case of taking an otherwise normal, well-balanced, rational human being, putting him in a bad situation and suddenly he turns bad, he said. "I faked it." He explained. "The first night was boring. Everyone was just sitting around. I thought, someone is spending a lot of money to put this thing on and they're not getting any results, so I thought I'd get some action going." He had just seen the Paul Newman prison movie Cool Hand Luke, in which a sadistic southern prison warden, played by Strother Martin, persecutes the inmates. So Dave decided to channel him. His sudden southern accent wasn't some uncontrollable physical transformation like when Natalie Portman sprouts feathers in Black Swan. He was consciously channeling Strother Martin. "So you faked it to give Zimbardo a better study?" I asked. "It was completely deliberate on my part," he replied. "I planned it, I mapped it out, I carried it through. It was all done for a purpose. I thought I was doing something good at the time." After I put the phone down, I wondered if Dave had just told me a remarkable thing, something that might change the way the psychology of evil was taught. He might have just debunked the famous Stanford prison experiment. And so I sent a transcript of the interview to the crowd psychologists Steve Reicher and Alex Haslam. They're professors of social psychology, Reicher at St Andrews University and Haslam at the University of Queensland. They spent their careers studying Zimbardo's work. Both of them emailed me back sounding totally unimpressed at the part I'd thought potentially sensational. "The only acting line is a red herring," Haslam wrote, "because if you're on the receiving end of brutality, it doesn't matter if the person was acting or not." "Acting is not unserious," Reicher added. "Even if we are performing, the question remains, why did we act in a particular way?" But, they both wrote, the conversation with Dave Eshelman was indeed fascinating and important, as Reicher put it, but for a different reason to the one I'd thought. There was a smoking gun, but it was something I hadn't noticed. "The really interesting line," Haslam wrote, "is, I thought I was doing something good at the time." The phrase, "doing something good," is quite critical. Doing something good. This was the opposite of Le Bon and Zimbardo's conclusions. An evil environment hadn't turned Dave evil. Those 100,000 people who piled in on Justine Sacco hadn't been infected with evil. The irony of those people who use contagion as an explanation, Steve Reicher emailed, is that they saw the TV pictures of the London riots, but they didn't go out and riot themselves. It is never true that everyone helplessly joins in with others in a crowd. The riot police don't join in with a rioting crowd. Contagion, it appears, is a problem for others. Then Reicher told me a story about the only time he ever went to a tennis match. It was a people's day at Wimbledon and the hoi polloi were allowed into the show courts. So we were on number one court. Three sides were ordinary folk, on the fourth were the members. The game we were watching was fairly boring, so people in the crowd started a Mexican wave. It went round the three popular sides of the court, and then the posh folk refused to rise. No contagion there. But the rest of the crowd waited just the time it would have taken for the wave to ripple through the fourth side. Time and again this happened, each time the mass, half jocular, urging the members to rise. And eventually they did, in a rather embarrassed way. The ensuing cheer could be heard a long way away. Now, on the surface, perhaps, one might talk of contagion. But actually there's a far more interesting story about the limits of influence coinciding with the boundaries between groups, about class and power, something contagion hides rather than elucidates. Even the most violent crowds are never simply an inchoate explosion. There are always patterns, and those patterns always reflect wider belief systems. So the question we have to ask, which contagion can't answer, is how come people can come together, often spontaneously, often without leadership, and act together in ideologically intelligible ways? If you can answer that, you get a long way towards understanding human sociality. This is why, instead of being an aberration, crowds are so important and so fascinating. Philip Zimbardo's assistant emailed, "Unfortunately, he is declining all further interview obligations until mid-fall due to a full schedule." It was February. I asked her if maybe she could let me know if he was going to be involved in any de-individuation projects. She said she wouldn't. "I receive many, many, many requests of this sort daily and simply cannot keep up with the requests to remember to be in touch with individuals," she wrote. I told her I'd spoken to Dave Eshelman and asked if I could at least do a fact check with Dr. Zimbardo. "He may be able to answer a few short questions in mid-May via email," she replied. And so in May I sent her Dave Eshelman's quotes. Doesn't the phrase, "doing something good," point to the opposite of Dr. Zimbardo's conclusions, I wrote. Dave Eshelman hadn't been infected by an evil environment. He was trying to be helpful. She forwarded my messages on to Dr. Zimbardo, writing, "Just send back to me, or I fear he will continue corresponding with you directly." I was accidentally copied in on the exchange. Zimbardo emailed me back later that evening. "Please suspend your naivete briefly," he wrote. Eshelman has publicly stated he decided to be the most cruel, abusive guard imaginable in videotaped interviews, that the prisoners were his puppets, that he decided to push them as far as he could until they rebelled. They never did, and he never let up. In fact, his degrading abuses escalated every night. Trying to be helpful, he created the evil environment that crushed innocent students and prisoners. Was Zimbardo right? I was being naive. Was Dave soft-soaping his brutality all these years later? I did more research and discovered that I wasn't the first person to have found the Zimbardo experiment a bit contrived. The Boston College psychologist Peter Gray, author of the widely used teaching aid Psychology, published an essay in Psychology Today titled Why Zimbardo's Prison Experiment Isn't in My Textbook. 21 boys, okay, young men, are asked to play a game of prisoners and guards. It's 1971. There have recently been many news reports about prison riots and the brutality of guards. So in this game, what are these young men supposed to do? Are they supposed to sit around talking pleasantly with one another about girlfriends, movies and such? No, of course not. This is a study of prisoners and guards, so their job clearly is to act like prisoners and guards, or more accurately, to act out their stereotyped views of what prisoners and guards do. Surely Professor Zimbardo, who is right there watching them as the prison superintendent, would be disappointed if, instead, they had just sat around chatting pleasantly and having tea. Much research has shown that participants in psychological experiments are highly motivated to do what they believe the researchers want them to do. Peter Gray, Why Zimbardo's Prison Experiment Isn't in My Textbook, Psychology Today, 19th of October 2013. Gray felt Zimbardo's critical error was awarding himself the role of superintendent instead of being some remote observer. And he was no aloof superintendent. Before the experiment began, he gave his guards a pep talk, as he later recounted in his own book, The Lucifer Effect. "We cannot physically abuse or torture them," I said. "We can create boredom. We can create a sense of frustration. We can create fear in them, to some degree. We can create a notion of the arbitrariness that governs their lives, which are totally controlled by us, by the system, by you, me, Warden Jaffe. They'll have no privacy at all. There will be constant surveillance. Nothing they will do will go unobserved. They will have no freedom of action. They will be able to do nothing and say nothing that we don't permit. We're going to take away their individuality in various ways. They're going to be wearing uniforms, and at no time will anybody call them by name. They will have numbers and be called only by their numbers. In general, what all this should create in them is a sense of powerlessness. We have total power in the situation. They have none." Philip Zimbardo, The Lucifer Effect, Random House, 2008. For Gustave Le Bon, a crowd was just a great ideology-free explosion of madness, a single blob of violent colour without variation. But that wasn't Twitter. Twitter did not speak with one voice. Within Justine Sacco's pylon, there had been misogynists. "Somebody HIV positive must rape this bitch and we'll see if her skin colour protects her from AIDS." Nobody went after that person, by the way. Everyone was so excited about destroying Justine, and our shaming brains are so simple-minded, we couldn't handle also destroying somebody who was inappropriately destroying Justine. There had been humanitarians. "If Justine Sacco's unfortunate words about AIDS bother you, join me in supporting CARE's work in Africa." There had been corporations promoting products, like the aeroplane Wi-Fi providers GoGo. "Next time you plan to tweet something stupid before you take off, make sure you are getting on a GoGo flight, CC Justine Sacco." All these people had, just as Steve Reicher said, come together spontaneously, without leadership. I wasn't one of them, but I'd piled in on plenty of people like Justine. I'd been beguiled by the new technology, a toddler crawling towards a gun. Just as with Dave Eshelman, It was the desire to do something good that had propelled me on, which was definitely a better thing to be propelled on by than group madness. But my desire had taken a lot of scalps. I'd torn apart a lot of people I couldn't now remember, which made me suspect that it was coming from a very